guys, it's basketball. It's not a f***ing soft sport.
I love it, Gabe. I love it.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the NBL Pocket Podcast. If you're a new listener, by all means, like, rate, subscribe, all that sort of stuff. But if you're wondering what we do on this program, well, on this particular podcast, we're going to be looking into all four of the games 1 and 2 played in the NBL this round between Perth and Cairns, Sydney and Melbourne. And then we're going to be looking at the big questions surrounding those games and the big questions surrounding the game 3s, which I believe begin on either Thursday or Friday this week. Exciting stuff. Let's not waste any time. Let's jump into game 1. And the first game of the semifinals was Perth versus Cairns. Perth winning this one in overtime, 108-107. So the way I want to break down each game is I want to look at the positives for the home team, the negatives for the home team, positives for the away team, negative for the away team, and then just a couple of general questions going forward. So positives for Perth, Nick Kay and Bryce Cotton were really unbelievable in this game. They combined for 65 points, 15 of 24 from the three-point line. Also in this, I had Brad Winter on earlier before the start of the semifinals, so if you're interested in that, definitely go back and have a listen, where he went through his sneaky big questions for the semifinals. And his first one was, can they make Damian Martin a negative? Well, in this game, he was very effective defensively, especially late in the fourth, especially in overtime, as was Mitch Norton, who's in a similar category, I'm sure Brad would agree. Negatives for Perth, Tariqo White and Miles Plumlee combined for 16 points, 5 of 13 in 52 minutes. They weren't effective, and nor did they play very much. Positives for Cairns, Machado and Nubel combined for 56 points, 20 of 30 from the field. It's ridiculous. Machado had 9 assists. And then also the fact that Nate Jawai was really effective in his minutes, had sort of 12 points in middle teens minutes, came in, was really effective. When he was on, they used him. When he wasn't, they didn't. But he was good too. Negatives for Cairns, 17 turnovers to Perth Wildcats 3. So they had 15 more turnovers than Perth. Just can't do that. Yes, Cairns won the rebound tally, but I mean, Perth missed more shots, so you know there's going to be more defensive rebounds. But they did concede 13 offensive rebounds, most of which came in overtime. Nick Kay grabbed 2, I think, in a simple play. Martin grabbed a couple in overtime. So when they especially needed, you can grab every offensive rebound, or I should say, you can deny your opponent every offensive rebound in the world, but if it comes down to overtime and you give up 5, well, you know, that's when you kind of need them more than ever. Callum Oliver did not have a great game in this game, I thought. The stats jump off the page, 19 points, 17 rebounds, but the truth of it was he didn't play well in the fourth quarter. I kept a log of his play because this is what I was watching for. Cam Oliver's the youngest guy in the starting 5 of any team in the semifinals, and I wanted to see how does a young man stand up to NBL finals pressure. So I kept a log of his play in the fourth. He had a pass deflected, and that was what I found really interesting in Perth timeouts. Trevor Gleeson has always gone on about deflections. He doesn't talk about steals or offensive rebounds or turnovers. They keep a tab of deflections, the Wildcats do. And I guess that's just a measure of their defensive disruptiveness. But anyway, Cam Oliver, first play, had a pass deflected. Can't recall if it turned into a turnover. Then he had a turnover. Then he committed a charge. Then he missed a free throw, made one free throw. He had the ball wrestled from him by Damian Martin on the baseline. An air ball at the 4:25 mark and a foul on Mitch Norton that he laid the ball in and went to the foul line to make the shot. So that was his fourth quarter. I don't think he scored other than that one free throw. So, you know, not a great fourth quarter. Great game from him, certainly early, but not so much late. Second quarter, Gleeson went to an interesting lineup. A Damian Martin, Bryce Cotton, Clint Steindl, Wagstaff, and Majuk lineup, and I did not like it at all. And neither did the metrics. At the 7-minute mark of the second quarter, Gleeson took Bryce Cotton out. The score was 31-28 and inserted, I believe, Tariqo White in his place, but I'm not sure. And in 1.5 minutes, the score went from 31-28 to 33-36, a 3-8 run, and Cotton was back in. That lineup, I don't know what he was thinking. And I do believe that if that lineup had never hit the floor, this game would have been very, very different. That lineup arrested momentum that halted momentum, but the lineup that arrested momentum back away from Cairns was a Cotton, Steindl, Tariqo White, Jesse Wagstaff, and Nick Kay lineup. In the third quarter, they took the score from 53-62 at the 5:30 mark, and then they took it to 68-71, so still conceded, 9 points, but scored 15 of their own, and it just got this team, not only got them a point differential and a point positive, but just got the game ticking over a little bit for the Wildcats, who have a tendency to bog down. And that was a span of about 3.5 minutes that they put on all those points. Conceded a few, but put on a few. All in all, this was probably the best finals game in NBL history. I don't think I'm speaking out of school saying that. This was an absolute joy to watch. If you like offense, this was a richly offensive game. Guys hitting shots. It was crazy. And I say it was the best finals game for a couple of reasons. Yeah, technically, number one, both teams shot a combined 51% from the field. That's always fun, but against good defense. And then I also thought it was the best game ever just because of tactically, the subtle changes that both coaches made were palpable and translated in the play. Like this game had so many different facets of the style of play. It was kind of fast, it was kind of slow, it was hitting the boards, it was hitting threes. And you could see these two coaches trying little subtle lineup changes and then the counteraction to that. This was like a symphony, you know, both coaches sort of in aggression against each other, but in harmony in a strange way. And I hope people saw it that way as well. Cairns made a realization, or perhaps an affirmation, that cotton is the heart and soul and bones, teeth, liver, stomach, anus, spleen, pancreas, epiglottis, and anything and everything else in between for the Perth Wildcats. A strategy of let cotton get his and contain the rest of the Wildcats, or who I call the wild cast, will not cut it. They took that knowledge into game two. We'll talk about that in a second. But what I'm driving at there is it's not like, oh, we'll let cotton get 30 because cotton won't stop. He's insatiable. He'll just keep scoring and scoring and scoring and scoring and scoring. He's one of those rare players who just keeps pushing on. There are some scorers who get to 30 and they have a mental block. They can't quite break it. It's like that 400-kilo mark in weightlifting. No one can get by it until one man did, and then everyone could. Cotton's not like that. He just plays every single play and keeps jumping high on all his jump shots all the way through the game. If you let him put up 45 in a grand final, he will. If you let him put up 40, 50, 60, he'll just keep going. They worked that out and took it into game two, but we'll talk about game two after. Let's talk about this really interesting game one between Sydney and Melbourne. And these two series have been polar opposites, but both equally intriguing and exciting. Sydney winning this one 86-80. Positives for Sydney, the home team. They won. And Brad Newley got to the line 10 of 12 in the third quarter predominantly. I think he may have gone in the fourth and a little bit in the first half, but he saved this game. He looked great in the third quarter attacking the basket and just stopping the threes, stopping the long rebound runouts that Melbourne seemed to be getting, and the tempo, that how that had increased the Melbourne tempo. Just slowed the game down a wee bit, but just put the ball in the hole so they could set up the defense better and not just blasting away from three. So he was definitely the player of the game for the Kings, I thought. Maybe Tate, who took over in the fourth. But negatives for Sydney, well, they shot 8 of 33 from the three-point line. 8 of 33, let that sink in. Lish, Bogut, Sean Bruce, Daniel Kickett were all ineffective and looked almost out of place on the court. The role definition they had in the season changed with the lineups in this series, and there was no adaption. Positives for Melbourne United. Trimble, Long, and Kidd, their three imports combined for 61 points, 21 of 42, that's 50%. You know, when a team's three imports fire, they are hard to stop. Just ask the Cairns Taipans. Negatives for the Melbourne United. Let's have a look. And the question I have for you out there, and it's a hard one to know, is did the imports' success come at the expense of the locals and the primary locals in the starting lineup? Mitch McCarron, Chris Golding, and David Barlow. That's my question to you. They combined for 10 points on 20% shooting and took some. At first, I was condemning. When I first saw the game, my initial thought was, have these two been paid off? Have they thought, oh, the, you know, Trimble and Long have got off and by hell or high water, I'm getting mine and I'm going to shoot the ball regardless? No, when I first had that thought, then I recanted when I watched this fourth quarter again in isolation. That quarter court shot that Golding took was with one on the shot clock. Mitch McCarron had done a rather poor job of managing clock in the situation. He committed that 8-second backcourt on the previous play, I believe. So, no, I recanted on thinking that, but still thought they weren't quite where they needed to be. But I spoke about that fourth quarter, and let's really dissect it from the Kings' perspective, how they made this comeback. Well, at the 6 minute and 37 second mark of the quarter. It's not like the Kings came out gangbusters either. Almost half the quarter was gone before they decided to do something about it. The score was 62-78 at that 6.5 minute mark. From that point on, Jayshon Tate put on 8 points, Lazada put on 5, and Casper Ware put on 5 to take over this game. What's that? 18 points to take them to 80, and then 6 was chipped in by, I think, Newley had a couple of points, and Sean Bruce had a runner, a few other things, but it was those three predominantly. Interestingly, Andrew Bogut, former MVP, comes out at the 4 minute and 30 second mark of the fourth and does not return. Daniel Kickett is in his place for the closing. I don't believe in home cooking. If you've heard my Twitter account or even this program, I don't think there's some referee conspiracy. However, I will say that I don't like the way that Michael Ahlen referees. I think he referees an unattractive game, a game that's straight-backed, much like his physical look. It's very straight, the shoulders are back, it's very technical, it's very formal, it's very regimented, it's like primary school. When I think that this game dictates you need more of a high school approach, a little bit more give and take, whereas Michael Ahlen's very put your bag in the box and lunchbox just so, and writing's on the board, up, mistake there, you've got one cross against your name, if it's three you're with me at lunch, you know, very, very contrary. Very, very contrary is how I'll leave that. And I say that because he had really two bad calls in the fourth, and that's, you know, when I just watched this game in isolation, I didn't watch the other three quite as closely. Quarter number four. First one was when Tate hurdled Long. Should have been two free throws. Long was clearly in an action going up. They took it side out of bounds, which I don't think was right. And then the second was the technical foul on Mello Trimble when he knocked it out of bounds and must have said something. But at that time, you've got to look up the clock and say there's a semi-final game, it's on the line, unless he said something racial or sexist or homophobic. I don't think he would have. Maybe he did. That's the other thing. I'll give Michael Ahlen a bit of a break here. I still stand by my critiques of his refereeing, but in this instance, I just feel like you would have to said something heinous to warrant a tech foul for Miller Trimble in that situation. And I'm skeptical it would have happened. Free throws. This is the dirty little secret. A little secret shame for United. They missed free throws, going 10 of 17 from the line. Sean Long and Toey Smith-Milner, the big offenders, both missing two in one trip at the line. And if you hit those, you just change the scoreboard pressure entirely and you got maybe a different game. So Sean Long and Toey Smith-Milner, the Hungry Jack's Grillmasters. The question I had coming out of this game is, who are the Sydney Kings' best players? Because there's such a democracy with the minutes there, it's hard to really tell who's their best players. And when you go to Cairns, you know exactly who it is. It's Scott Machado, it's DJ Newbill, it's Cam Oliver, in whatever order you want to place them, but it's those three. And then Majuk Deng, Kwat Noi, and Jerich kind of filling in the blanks. But Sydney, it's not quite so obvious. But so I had to kind of ask myself the question and do it again, because their rotation is so deep. And it's my thought that they've kind of, certainly in this semifinals, they've lost their identity in a sea of depth, revolving door rotations, and Twitter love-ins. But to answer my own question, who are Sydney's best players? For me, it's, and I think I could put them in this order as well, Jayshon Tate, Casper Ware, Brad Newley and Andrew Bogut sort of interchangeably, Didi Luzada and Xavier Cooks. I feel like that's their best 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Kevin Lish is a fine player, but he's played 9 games this season and very few minutes in those games. And he's been hurt all year. I just don't think he's the guy you want to all of a sudden inject into your starting lineup. Craig Moller, 14 games played. Okay, a little bit more. We're at half the season. But he missed most of his games in the later part of the year and barely played. He played 10, 15 minutes. Their presence dilutes the established chemistry that we saw over the last couple of weeks when this team was playing well. I, like a lot of people, I think was very surprised to see Kevin Lish in the starting lineup and was more surprised to see him still there in game two, but we'll get to that after. So the question we all want to say is, and Shane Hill was hammering on this, pardon the pun, on the commentary, was what changes are Sydney going to make season to finals, game to game, and then even play to play? There doesn't seem to be that fluidity amongst their coaching and then onto the floor. So what change will we see going into game two? Now, this is easy to say now that we've seen game two, but even at the time, it was, will the absence of Deshaun Taylor continue to hurt this team as much as it seems to have so far. Lish and Bruce were a combined 8 points, 4 of 10, 0 of 5 from the outside with 2 turnovers in this game. Taylor is just another guy who can guard Melo Trimble and has had success against really good point guards in the NBL in the last sort of 5 to 7 rounds of the regular season. I don't see how that would have changed coming into this matchup. And I think he just gives Melo Trimble a little bit something else to think about other than just Casper Ware, who's expending a lot of energy. Kevin Lish, who's trying to find his form, and Sean Bruce, who's not the defender that Taylor is. And I think that's fair to say. But that was my question from game 1 to 2. Let's jump into game 2. Let's look at this first one, Cairns and Perth. Cairns 85, Perth 74, an 11-point loss, low scoring. Talk about swinging as the pendulum do from one side to the other. Let's go with the standardized testing here. Positives for Cairns. They held Bryce Cotton and Nick Kay to a combined 21 points on 8 of 24 shooting. That's 33%. I didn't have the time to look through the game logs, but when has that happened? When have those two combined for 21? Normally it's Cotton struggles, Kay does okay or better, or vice versa. This game it was both of them. 33% for only 21 points. Crazy. Also positive for Cairns, they limited turnovers in this battle, winning the turnover battle 12-14, which is exceptionally rare against the Perth Wildcats, even on the road. And they minimized the offensive rebounding discrepancy. They still lost in offensive rebounds, but Perth only grabbed 11, which is down on their season average and down on game one. So you could call that a bit of a victory. Nate Jawai continues to be super productive in his minutes, even against the bigger body Plumlee when you thought maybe he wouldn't. Negatives for Cairns. Not many. I guess the one I could pluck out is Mirko Jeric continues to lay dormant, 1 of 5 from the outside in this series. So we'll see how that goes. Positives for Perth Wildcats. Let's jump the other side of the coin. They lost a tough game against a tough team and return home for game 3. This is why we play the regular season, to see who gets top spot and home court when it's most important. They also lost this game, a tough game, against a tough team in a historically bad game for their two best players. And they only lose by 11. So, you know, it's all about how you phrase these things. At least they didn't lose by 45. Negatives for Perth. I'm just going to put it out there. Mitch Norton, 22 minutes, 3 points, 1 of 8 from the field. Most of those misses coming at the rim. Some were three-pointers, sure. But most were layups that then went straight the other way. And then also a really bad sprung a mental leak type unsportsmanlike foul late. You know, what do the Wildcats do about this? This was one of Brad's questions. Can they turn Damian Martin into a negative? So the question is, can Mitch Norton make that a positive or even just a break even, a parity? Certainly didn't do it in this game. And I also wanted to look at this in the long term and in the short term. I want to do the long term first. This, I think, is a problem for the Wildcats going forward. Who are they going to team up in the backcourt with? With Bryce Cotton, and alleviate some of his ball handling duties to not tire him out so much. So in the long term, for me, is this is a bit of a departure from the finals, but in the long term, you've got three imports, and let's say Bryce Cotton remains an import and doesn't get his citizenship. I think you use that third import spot to address this issue. You move on from Plumlee and spend that import slot and its money on a John Robertson type or a creator or a bit of both. I know it's easy to say go out and get John Robertson, who's an MVP candidate. It's never that easy, but you know, pair up this backcourt and then pick the bones of the lower teams for a local big who can play hard and set screens for you. I think you can get, you obviously get greater bang for your buck in the import market in the smaller players, wings and in particular guards and point guards. Bigs seem to get snapped up by Europe. They seem to be more expensive. You get less for your money. So Sean Long being probably the only real exception. So then you look at the lower teams. Who could be an effective local who can do what the Wildcats need? Attentive on defense, hard screen setter. And to me, I mean, without just putting anything out there, the answer to me might be Harry Froehling. Had a bad year in Adelaide and certainly some bad press after the year as well, but big body. He's an aggressive player. You might have to channel that into more of a Wildcat fashion. He was often a little, not unhinged, but a little bit erratic perhaps in Adelaide and before that. If you can channel his assets, I feel like you've got something there with Froehlich. I think you get better value from him than you do from spending your import spot on a big. In the short term, though, let's go back to the finals. In the short term, you know, the question is how many minutes or how effective can a team of the team that was very good in game one or the lineup that was very good in game one, how much can you get out of Cotton, Tarico White, Clint Steindl, Jesse Wagstaff, Nick Kay? Is that a lineup that you can play bigger or major minutes or start a game with against any lineup or indeed against Cairns? The question for me is how do you take the eyes off Cotton even for a fraction? How do you help him out there? Trying to hang up his defenders on screens all the time has become predictable. Now, it's also effective, but it has certainly become predictable. What else can be done? What else can you do in a final series to get your opponent thinking? Because that's where we've seen the most success for teams, the semifinal, when the other team is thinking about what they're going to do. When you're even effective in what you do all the time, like the Sydney Kings are, people just tend to work you out. It's like in a military situation. If you're just bunkering down and holding fort and not, you know, a moving target. What is it? A sitting target is a sitting duck. And I feel like that's kind of what the Wildcats have become with Cotton a little bit, and certainly the Sydney Kings a bit. But then on the other side of that is how do the Wildcats make Miles Plumlee more effective? Hunt was too small. Is Plumlee too big and slow? Not really. Like, he's got pretty good ups and he's got great hands and, you know, I think he's a pretty good player. So, and the reason why I asked that question is in the preseason, there was talk that Perth were going after Taco Fall. I think it was a bit of a joke. And Gleeson himself even came out and said something, and I'm paraphrasing, but he goes, 7-footers don't really seem to play well in our league. They prefer the smaller, undersized power forward tends to go a little bit better or centre power forward. And that could certainly be expanded to most leagues, certainly the NBA, where, you know, the death of the big man, quote-unquote. So is it a matter of Plumlee not keeping up, or has Gleeson lost faith in not only Plumlee specifically, but the position and the role? I really think it's the latter. I think it's Gleeson sort of pulling the pin on Plumlee a little too early in games, and certainly not having him all year, but we can't help that now. So I think the Wildcats should really start to look for him rolling, get him setting good picks and reward him so he's not just setting pick after pick after pick and feels like a linebacker out there. You know, let him feel part of the game and let him get his hands on it, and hopefully that minimizes his sort of frustration or lack of attentive fouls that he sometimes gives. You know, grabbing the rim on layups and things. He did that a bunch this year. So if you can keep him invested, keep him thinking on offense, I think that'll be better. See what happens. Second game, or game two, Melbourne United and Sydney. Melbourne smashing. I mean, this is the one that made all the headlines. Melbourne 125, Sydney Kings 80. A 45-point loss for the Kings. Regicide, I've got here in capital letters. I mean, this was a murder. This was a massacre. This was a lot of things. Let's go with Melbourne first. The positives. Well, they won by 45 points. They picked up right where they left off after the third quarter of game one. I mean, the good thing is this play, I mean, it was probably a little bit, the dial turned up some, but it still wasn't too dissimilar from how they played in the first three quarters of game one. In this series, they've won 7 of 8 quarters of basketball. And also, you know, we talk about adjustments in the finals and giving people something to think about, especially your defenders and your opponent. Starting Stanton Kidd over David Barlow and waiting till now to do it. I'd been pushing for United to do this a while ago, and I kind of like the strategy of releasing it now and going quicker and really running Kings off the floor. It seemed to energize him, and when I say Kidd going into the starting lineup, it seemed to energize him and also their collective defense. I feel like having a third American out there with those guys, with Trimble and Long, it just felt a greater synergy, perhaps. Maybe that's too esoteric, but let's go on. Negatives for Melbourne United, if there are any. Well, the big negative is they lost game one. And they shouldn't have lost game one. If they hadn't lost game one, they'd be over. This would be done. And as a result of losing game one, they lost the home court advantage. So, you know, good on you. You've won a game at home. You're supposed to have done this. Now, 45 points was not supposed to happen, but you've won a game in a semifinal. Great. Now you got to go back to Sydney, home of the best team in the league, and win. So it's still not, you know, if it counted for two, if there was a rule where three over 30 points counted for two wins, well, then we're talking, but it hasn't. So they're still fighting the stat that says 21 of 22 winners of game one win the series. So my question to you guys out there is, does a 45-point loss in one game render that 95% winning percentage, does it diminish that or perhaps make it moot? I don't know if it does. I still think the stat is, if you win game one, you're more than likely going to win game two or three and win the series. The percentage of teams who've suffered a huge loss like this and gone on to lose the series would be nowhere near like 95%, if you know what I mean. Like I think the Celtics in 87 against the Lakers got beat by 33 and then went on to win that series. So it'd be interesting to look at in finals how often a team is beaten this badly or say by 30 points plus and come back to win the series. It wouldn't be 95% of the time they lose. Maybe I'm clutching it at a stat too tightly, possibly. But big losses, they just happen. Although this was horrific. Let's look at the positives for the Sydney Kings. I really didn't think there were any, and I'll tell you why there weren't any. No one found any form or was afforded the opportunity to establish a rhythm by seeing the ball go through the hole that perhaps they could take into a game three. Lish didn't get some cheap points at the end to get his confidence back. Casper Ware hit a shot and was subbed out late in the fourth. Sean Bruce has struggled from the field all series and didn't look like he got any footing in this game. Craig Moller didn't get a good run. He only played his usual 12 minutes. It's not like they thought, well, we need him to be big going forward. Let's give him 25. Screw it. Daniel Kickett, again, played big minutes, only scored 9 points. Didn't see the ball go through the hole. Wasn't able to be effective on the court. So, you know, and most of these guys I've named, Lish, Ware, Bruce, Moller, Kickett, most of them were subbed out after making shots or playing well. Bizarre. I would have thought at that point you'd just kind of go rover a bit, or maybe you don't. Maybe that's exactly what they're trying not to do. Let's look at the negatives for Sydney after this game. Okay. Obviously, there's a lot, but I'm trying not to overreact. There's a big overreact to a loss like this, and naturally so, and quite rightly so, I suppose, but I'm trying to really keep a laser focus on the negatives because you could just absolutely pound the shit out of this team. But what I had was their style of offensive play hasn't seemed to play to their strengths, both personnel strength and collective strength. Nor have they shown an ability to adjust. I know that's a cliche, but nor have they shown an ability to adjust. So the word I want to use is like adapt, intensify, or streamline. They haven't... I don't think they know that they're playing finals now, and maybe that's their counter-argument would be, well, we're just doing what we've done all season. So it's really a question for everyone out there is, you know, are the finals different? I think they're very different. I think things change. You need to just streamline your approach. You need to trim the fat. Your rotations need to come down a wee bit. You know, things like that. You need to intensify. You need to streamline. You can't do what you did in the regular season. Although the regular season is short in the NBL, you know, compared to say the NBA or what have you, it's still not the same thing. It's what you did against Illawarra in October won't work against Melbourne in early March, and I don't think that's a silly thing for me to say. This team is not trying to do anything different to what worked all season. I thought maybe I'd find a bigger stat discrepancy, you know, like I really thought maybe they're just taking an absurd number of threes that they didn't in the regular season, or maybe they just haven't been attacking the goal and getting to the foul line. The stats say the complete opposite, that they've done exactly the same thing. They averaged 33 three-point attempts on the season. In this final series, they're taking 1.5 more three-point attempts. They averaged 21 free throw attempts on the season, so that to me is a measure of how much they're attacking the basket. It's not the most accurate measure by all means, because often you go to the basket and score and aren't fouled, but it's a pretty good measure nonetheless. So they averaged 21 free throw attempts on the season, 22 in the finals. So it's not like they've gone away from their game plan. They cannot be accused of doing that, but maybe that is the problem, and I think that's what a lot of people out there are saying. Obviously the big statistical discrepancy between what worked for them all year is they shot 33% from the three on the season. They're averaging 26 in this series, so 7% less, and that does matter when it's three-point attempt. So the question is, what's the answer? Well, the shots aren't dropping. So, you know, Weaver could get in his press conference and say, we're getting good looks and we're just missing them. Is that an answer that holds water? Is it good enough? And is it a smart one as well? There's a lot of answers to this question. How do you play better? Variance. Doing something different. Melbourne United have become too accustomed to how they play. And really, in defense of the shooting, the shots haven't been bad. You know, they haven't been a quarter-court shot like what Chris Golding took. You know, I feel like I'm picking on him, but it's just an example. You know, a lot of the shots have come off pretty good rotation. Guys have been open. You know, Cook's had three great attempts in game one. Didn't make any of them. Didn't even look like making any of them. Sean Bruce had some decent looks. He's strong-arming them. You know, they just... Casper Ware has had good looks in this series, as good a looks as he had all through the regular season. He's just not making them. So you can either keep banging your head against the wall and saying, oh, well, eventually they'll go down, or you can try something different. To me, the answer is Tate, Ware, Bogut. These guys can play, and a lot of stuff has been spoken about Andrew Bogut. He's done. He's no good. He doesn't step up in big games. That was an interesting conversation on Twitter. And I appreciated that conversation as well. But, man, Andrew Bogut's not done. He was MVP last year. He played huge minutes. He scored quite well. He rebounded. He blocked shots. He didn't block a single shot in this game. But more than Bogut, Jayshon Tate, Casper Ware. Let Casper Ware operate a bit more and take the focus away from the arc. Let him get to the basket. He's a lot stronger than Melo Trimble. And a better offensive player than Trimble is defensively. He can take him. But also engage Trimble and Long defensively. The start of the year was all about how these two are going to struggle a little bit defensively, Trimble and Long. And I don't think they've certainly stepped up their game, but they're not all of a sudden defense player of the year candidates or nothing. So engage him defensively. Put some fouls on him. Put a little heat on him. Put some pressure on him at the hoop. You know, Bogut is stronger than Jean Long. He is stronger than him. And, you know, while the right arm is gone, he can score with the left. He can hook. He can score. He can dunk. This is a guy who had some pretty big plays last year and even earlier this year. They've mollycoddled him and he's bought into it. But we'll talk about that in a bit. Yeah, here's what there you go. Andrew Bogut, engaged and active. Get the head over the ball, looking to score. Not necessarily drop 25, but to be a factor and an offensive change agent. Make something happen. This guy is 35, not 105. He's seemingly got in his head that he is this busted up, over the hill, damaged good, whose only purpose is to take up space in the paint and rebound. This is Andrew fucking Bogut. He can dunk, he can, you know, as those things, he can put it, and more the point, he can put the ball on the deck, he can find teammates. Coach of the Golden State Warriors, Mark Jackson, and others have pigeonholed his game for too long. Let him go. Let him explore. Let him feel it. If the body's not up to it, don't go. Don't get on the floor. If you can't give 25 minutes, then you're not a starter. Come off the bench. Don't come in the game. But I don't think that's the case. I think just their style has just given him a role that I think he's over-educated and over-talented for and over-equipped for. If there is no change to the starting lineup or rotation in game three by Sydney Kings and Will Weaver, I'll be flabbergasted. I would think a return to the Casper Ware, Didi Luzada, Brad Newley, Jayshon Tate, Andrew Bogut starting lineup that we saw so often during the regular season would be, should be on the cards. It'd be interesting to see if they do. And then also a bench cull. Trim this bench down to Cooks, Bruce, and kick it exclusively. I'm sorry, Lish, and I'm sorry, Moller, but you've been hurt. You just haven't been a part of it. And, you know, there's just not the confidence there from them and their play. You know, maybe address it later on, but certainly get a good start to a game. I feel like their starts have been quite poor. Yeah, bring in Luzada. Let him play. He was great in the fourth quarter of the game one. Let him play. Let him explore. You know, I feel like this team's a little cagey. Get out and run. If Casper Ware plays less than 30 minutes, I will fall out of my chair. If he plays less than 35, I'd be surprised. Casper Ware is a very good player. The substitution pattern, I feel like, has altered the confidence he has in his shot. That's what I put it down to. There's also a personal responsibility on his part. He's just not making them, and he's gotten decent looks. But I feel like he makes a shot, he comes out. I don't like it. I haven't liked it for a while now. They should put him in the John Stockton rotation pattern, which is coming out before the halftime and a few other things. But a structured, longer extended breaks, less choppy, changey in and outs for him. More long-standing play on the court, I think, is when he's at his strength. 8 minutes in a row, not forward and four with a two-minute gap. Maybe that's just me. I also think there was a missed opportunity for Andrew Bogut to sit with Will Weaver at the press conference. It was Brad Newley who did it, and he was good. No problem there. But let Andrew Bogut sit in it. If I was Will Weaver, I'd have come in and gone, I'm going to take Andrew Bogut and select. I think that's how they do it. The coach choose who they want. And maybe players put their hand up. And maybe Bogut said, I don't want to do it. But I would have insisted if I was Weaver. I said, no, come on, big guy. Get out here. Sit down. Wear it. I think even Paul Smith came out on Twitter himself and said, if you're going to eat a shit sandwich, grab it with both hands, take a big bite. And I agree. And I think Bogut would have enjoyed sitting there. Let him hear the questions. Let him feel the room. Interact with the media. He likes interacting with the media. Likes causing a stir. It might have been a nice opportunity to not only for him to stir up the media, but to stir something inside himself and really put his foot down and say, no, I'm not. I has been. I'm actually a good player. And plus, it would have been really entertaining to see, one of the league's biggest faces answer questions. And that's no offense to Brad Newley at all. Little bit of a sneaky little question here. I sent a message out to Liam Santa Maria on Twitter. I asked, what is Deshaun Taylor's status? Can he play? And he is there. Nominated player replacement. If there is an illness or injury, Deshaun Taylor will play. Illness or injury there. Illness being the key word. Coronavirus has hit our shores. Maybe it'll hit the City Kings locker room. I don't know. That's not a question for me. But Deshaun Taylor, if he was with this team, I think they would be better. I think they would have another defensive opportunity on Trimble. And I spoke about this before. Just something different to look at. And I also think that Taylor is a streaky but confident long-range shooter. He didn't hit them early on when he joined the NBL, and in the last couple of rounds certainly has. And I think go with it. But more than anything with the Sydney Kings, they need to look at a book and an author by the name of Sam Anderson, author of a book called Boomtown, about the Oklahoma City Thunder. He writes in that book, and he writes about the sport of basketball itself. He says, more than any other sport, it is a game of civics. Every player on every play has to find the proper balance between self-interest and self-sacrifice. Zach Lowe in his podcast was very fond of that line, and that's what spurred me to go on and reach out for the book. I'm going to read it again. More than any other sport, basketball is a game of civics. Every player on every play has to find the proper balance between self-interest and self-sacrifice. Can the Kings find the proper balance? Will they maintain their sporting friendship? Or will they win the NBL championship? Only one civic responsibility will hold water. Bit of a water boat theme there. Thanks very much, everyone. That's the end of it. Rate, review, subscribe. I'm hoping to get Brad Winter back on the program to talk about maybe if he's arrived at some answers to his sneaky big questions. That's for me and Brad to work out. Fingers crossed. Thanks very much.